Hello, everyone. Welcome to Broken Bread. I'm Ron Bailey from BibleBase.com and working with Mike Coles from newliferadio.co.uk in Exeter, and combining together and enjoying our fellowship together in bringing you this series of studies in the letter to the Galatians. I won't go through the letter to the Galatians, introducing it again. If you haven't heard the other aspects of this, this is number 11 we're doing today. If you haven't heard the others, you can get them on podcast from Bible-based podcast. You can get them on Mike's radio program. You can get them on BibleBase.com. So they're all over the place. You can't escape them. And we do hope that you'll be blessed by these and benefited by them. So we're looking at the letter to the Galatians, and we've been trying to take a sort of a style that is reminiscent for me anyway of a time when I used to gather with half a dozen or 10 people around a table. Most of them were from other countries. And we would go through things, something like the letter to the Galatians and other things, in something that we call the Church Life School in Reading in the UK. And they were times of very great blessing, and I enjoyed them very much. And I want to go at that sort of a level. And I want to do something particular that you may not be expecting, but I'm going to try and stick with everything I want to say. I'm going to try and stick as much as I can to the letter to the Galatians, because I want us to try and understand this letter in the context of the people to whom it was written. Remember, of course, that the people to whom it was written did not have the letter to the Romans to clarify any points that they might have been unsure about. They didn't have any of the letters. This is almost certainly the first of Paul's letter writing ministry. So I'm going to try and keep it contained within the letter to the Galatians, and that means there are some things that we won't touch on, but if you're interested in following them up in the letter to the epistle to the Romans, you can find those too on BibleBase.com. There's a whole series of more than 20 different sessions, I think, called the Romans Project, or its subtitle was The Gospel According to Paul. And we go through using presentations and lots of kind of ways to help people understand what's happening, the details of that. And with that one too, I tried to stick in Romans and not to stray out into Galatians. So here we are in Galatians. And if you've only just joined us, don't worry, we haven't got very far yet. We've been talking about a principle that I call context, context, context. It simply means that if we're going to understand the big picture of the book of the epistle, to the Galatians, we need to kind of be mindful of the context of the man who wrote it, of his personal context, what had happened to him, who he was, of his context in that particular period of his life, what had happened. We also wanted to look at the context of the early churches at this stage and how they were becoming under, they were coming under attack from a group of people who were really kind of called, we call them Judaizers. They were people who wanted essentially, and this isn't too strong a language, they were people who were wanting to hijack the Christian revelation and make it a sort of a subsection of Judaism. But the only thing with that was that they insisted that Gentiles who became Christians, in order to become part of the full community of God's people, they must go the whole hog, and that included circumcision and the keeping of the law. And there are different stages, as we've seen, that battle heating up. And this is before, I say that this is in between Acts chapter 14 and Acts chapter 15. And Acts chapter 15, of course, is that great conference that we looked at, I think it was last week or the week before that. Anyway, here we are, study number 11. Welcome, welcome. Please do listen to this and let us know how you're finding it, whether it's touching the spot. I'm going to read some verses from Galatians chapter 2. And it's part of this confrontation. I think it was a loving confrontation of Paul and Peter. I don't think that Paul had lost his patience or temper with him. These were very important issues. But I think this is an admonition rather than an outright rebuke. I don't think Paul would have wanted to humiliate Peter or anybody else at this, but it was important that this thing should be dealt with openly. So let me read these verses from Galatians chapter 2 and beginning to read, just so that you have the context, in verse 14. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, "If you, being a Jew, live in the manner of the Gentiles and not as the Jews, why do you compel Gentiles to live as Jews? We, who are Jews by nature and not sinners of the Gentiles, knowing that a man is not justified by works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Christ Jesus that we might be justified by faith in Christ, and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law no flesh shall be justified. But if, while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, is Christ therefore a minister of sin? Certainly not. For if I build again those things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. For I, through the law, died to the law, that I might live to God. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not set aside the grace of God. For if righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died in vain." I'm going to divide that up into three sections, and this is going to give me my title for this session. I'm going to call it You, We, I. Just those three personal pronouns, as the grammar people would call them. You, we, I. And there's something that happens in the Greek language that the New Testament was written in, which is really quite interesting. In kind of company with some other languages, and certainly I know I had a smattering of Spanish. I did Spanish for a year at school and learned how to say, "I have a pencil." It's not much of a conversation holder, but it gets you going. And I discovered this about the Spanish language, that you don't need to use the pronoun I in Spanish. You can just simply say, "Tengo un lápiz." Sorry about my accent. This is how we speak Spanish in North Staffordshire. So, "tengo un lápiz" means "I have a pencil." But there is a Spanish pronoun for I, which is "yo." And if I put "yo" at the beginning of that sentence, "yo tengo un lápiz," it's emphatic. It's a way of saying, "I have a pencil." I might be in a conversation and you say, "Well, has everyone got a pencil?" And I might say, "I have a pencil." And I'm distinguishing myself. Or I might say, "I have something," in order to distinguish and separate me from others. Now, that happens in the Greek language. You don't need these pronouns to make sense of what you're trying to say. But the pronouns do exist. And if they're written down, they are what grammarians call emphatic pronouns. So I've got three emphatic pronouns that I want to base this little talk on tonight. First of all, "you." And it's here in verse 14. "When I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, 'If you..." Now, can you see that this actually tells you how to read it? This is, Paul really is saying, if you, being a Jew, live in the manner of the Gentiles and not in the Jews, why do you compel the Gentiles to live as the Jew? In fact, it's singular in biblical Greek. So it's really, if thou, being a Jew, if you personally, it's the equivalent almost of someone putting his finger on your chest and saying, "You, it's you I'm talking about. If you, being a Jew, live in the manner of the Gentiles and not as the Jews, Why do you compel Gentiles to live as Jews? You see, Peter had been living as a Gentile in the church at Antioch in Syria. He'd been eating with them, they'd been doing things together, but something had happened which had changed his behavior, and Paul saw really the fatal implications of what he was doing. And so he faced Peter with this statement, "Why are you doing that?" Now, the second one of these emphatic pronouns begins in verse 15, and this is the word "we." So he moves from "thou," something that he's addressing personally to Peter, and then he moves on to the "we." And this is why I think some people aren't quite sure how long this conversation went on for, whether it was just actually verse 14, or whether it was verse 14 down to verse 18, or whether it was verse 14 right to the end of the chapter. My feeling is that it probably goes down to the end of verse 18. But we'll take this next little section. I'm going to call this the sort of the "we" section. Actually, it's verse 15 down to verse 17. He says this, "We." Now, he's going to emphasize something here. "We." Who is we? Well, we who are Jews by nature. He's going to talk about the law, and he's going to talk about the effect that the law had upon the people of the law. You probably know that even in modern times, when a young man reaches a certain time in a Jewish family, he has what's known as a bar mitzvah. He becomes a son of the law. He takes upon himself the burden, the yoke, that's the word they use. He takes upon him the yoke of the law. He becomes personally responsible. Up until that time, his behavior has been the responsibility, ultimately, of his father. But from the moment he takes on the yoke himself, then he becomes personally accountable. That's the way that they understand things at this time. So the Jews, and it's referred to in the scriptures as a yoke too, the Jews had been given this amazing privilege of God. Amongst all the other blessings of God, the greatest thing was that God had entrusted to them his oracles, his speaking, so that they knew the mind of God. They knew it in a way that the Gentiles didn't know. The Gentiles knew basic aspects of the law as it was in their hearts, but they didn't know the specific items of the law in the way that God gave them to the Jewish people. And we shall come on a little bit later in the next chapter to ask the question, if the law didn't fulfill any purpose in making people righteous, in that case, what was the purpose of it? And we'll answer that question, but not tonight. Paul here says we who are Jews by nature and not sinners of the Gentiles. He's making the distinction because Gentiles, the simplest definition of Gentiles is that he is someone outside the Mosaic covenant, someone outside the Sinai covenant. When God brought the people, the families of Israel, to Sinai, he entered into a covenant with them, and you became mine, he said to them later on, speaking through Ezekiel. And they became his in a unique sense. And that was a solemn, legal obligation that God and the people entered in through the mediation, through the channel of a mediator whose name was Moses. And Moses was the mediator of the Old Covenant or of the Sinai Covenant. And those who accepted and gave themselves wholeheartedly to that covenant were accepted as God's people. Actually, not only the bloodline of Abraham, but others too responded. People like Caleb, who wasn't actually from the bloodline of Israel. So Paul is making a distinction here. And the Jews referred to themselves as those who had the revelation, those who had the truth, Jews to whom had been entrusted the law. They referred to the rest, the people who were not part of that covenant, the Gentiles, as sinners. They were outside the law. They were outlaws in the sense that if you drew a circle around a company of people who were going to become God's people because they'd entered into a covenant with him, then the Gentiles weren't in that circle. So they were on the outside. So they were not keepers of the law, but they were sinners because they had no law in that sense. They weren't outside. They were outside Israel's law. And then Paul explains it like this, and he says, this is what we know. We know that a man is not justified by the works of the law. Now, this is a strong statement. This word justify is going to become a key word here in this passage of Galatians that we're looking at tonight. So we'll give it a very simple definition. I heard this many, many years ago of a group of people who were working translating the Bible into one of the mother tongues of the natives, the indigenous peoples of Papua New Guinea. And they were trying to tell basic stories about Jesus so that they could understand some aspects of truth, and then they were moving on to gospel truths. And they used the language that's known as Pidgin English. Now, for English people, it's quite amusing because it uses English words, but not in a way that English people would expect them to be used. And it really is very poetic and very creative, the way that they use that line. And the translators were trying to find some expression which would explain what the implication to this phrase justified, or this word justified, means. And I think it was inspirational because they came up with this little phrase, God, him say, me okay. I'm not being patronizing when I do that. That's Pidgin English. God, him say, me okay. And it is almost perfect theologically. Because justification is the act of God. What we're doing here is we're dipping into what's sometimes known as the forensic background. That means from the law court. God uses words from different sources to convey truth. And this justification is part of a legal process that was known in one particular way by the Jewish people, but in a very particular way by the Romans. And of course, Paul in Galatia is in kind of Roman provinces and colonies and all the rest of it. The Romans gave law to our world. Greeks gave philosophy. The Hebrews gave religion. The Jews gave law. So God is the judge. And it doesn't matter what anybody else says. Ultimately, it matters what the judge says. So this is good to have God right at the beginning of this little definition. God, him say. It doesn't matter what anybody else says. It doesn't matter what your battered conscience says. It doesn't matter what others say. It doesn't matter what people who want to fix a doctrinal collar on you say. What matters is what God says. God, him say, me okay. Let me explain it very quickly. This belongs more particularly to the letter to the Romans, but remember, the people who received this letter had not read the letter to the Romans. So they're no better off than you were in many ways. Okay, a Roman law court starts off with an accusation. Someone brings an accusation, and you can see this in the trials of Jesus and in the trials of Paul, and they are supposed to be there to make the application in person. And they make the accusation, and then there is a trial in which judgment takes place. I mean judgment as a process, not as a verdict at the end of the process. I mean the process of judging, assessing the evidence, listening to the witnesses, making their mind up. This was a single judge, more like an English magistrate. That was sort of the pattern of it. They didn't have juries in the way that we did. So they bring the accusation, the judge listens to it, and then he makes his decision. And if his decision is that the person is guilty, then there are some other steps to the process. If he is found guilty of the charge that's been brought against him, then the next stage is that he will pronounce him guilty. First of all, he judges him guilty, then he pronounces him guilty, and then he gives the sentence, and then there is the carrying out of the sentence. But of course, if the person is found not to have been proven guilty of the charge which was being brought against him, then the process stops right there. It just ends with that verdict that this person is not guilty of the charge which is brought against him. So the judge makes that judgment, and the judge makes that pronouncement, and that is handed over to people who will carry out the sentence. So, after the accusation comes the judgment. Paul here says, a man is not judged right with God by the works of the law, by law works. That's all, actually, one, just two words. The works of the law are actually just two words. Law works. This is a really important and truth for us to grasp, that it was never God's intention that man should create his own do-it-yourself righteousness by keeping a list of do's and don'ts. That was never the purpose of the law, and we'll see the purpose later on. But that's what the Jewish people made it. They made it a kind of a ladder by which they could ascend to a level at which God would have to accept them because they had done what they were supposed to have done. Well, Paul says here, speaking by the Spirit of God categorically, by the works of the law, by doing that, that righteousness will never get you justified. You will never have a verdict of you are right with me. God will never say to a human being, you are right with me, you're okay with me, because you have kept all these laws. Never. And then Paul gives the positive side of it. You're not justified by law works, but by faith in Jesus Christ. This isn't faith in the idea of Jesus Christ. It's not faith in doctrines about Jesus Christ. This is faith in the person of Jesus Christ. He's a very, very old story from Victorian times of a very clever acrobat whose name was Blondel. And he was particularly very clever working on the high wire, the tightrope. And on one occasion, he decided he would do something spectacular. They spread a cable across the Niagara Falls. And then he said he would walk across. And he walked across with his balancing pole, and the people on the other side cheered at this amazing exploit. And he did it again. Then he got a bicycle that they'd taken the tires off, so you just had the rims, and he rode across using his balancing pole, and then rode back again, and the people were even more ecstatic by this point. Then he got a wheelbarrow, and he filled it with sacks of potatoes, and he wheeled it across to the other side and wheeled it back again, and the people were even more ecstatic this time. I'm not making this up. This is a true story. Blondel was so adept at his work on the high wire that on one occasion he actually took a small spirit stove, what in England they'd call paraffin, which I think in the United States they call, not gasoline, what do they call it? I've forgotten. It'll come to me when all this is over. And fried himself an omelette on the high wire, halfway between America and Canada at the Niagara Falls. Stunning. Then he had another, his greatest feat of all. He addressed the crowd and he said, do you believe that I could take a man across this wire in my wheelbarrow? And they all said, yes. Great crowds of acclamation and cheers. And yes, they believed it. And he said, can I have a volunteer? And then everything went very quiet. You see, they believed he could do it, but they weren't willing to put their life into his hands. It's not sufficient to believe that Christ can do it. It's not sufficient to believe that all the truths about him are in fact true. It's not sufficient to hold the right doctrines. It's not sufficient to have all the right answers to the questions. This is faith in a person. This is a personal trust and giving over your life into the hands of another person. And Paul says this, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. Even we Jews, who had all the advantages, we've had the priesthood, we've had the covenants, we've had the promises, we've had all these things, and yet we weren't justified by the works of the law. Even we have believed in Christ Jesus, we put our faith in Christ, so that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by the works of the law. For, this is the conclusion, for by the works of the law, no flesh shall be justified. So this is an absolute. It's only faith in Christ. As we put our trust in him, acknowledging that we have not deserved his favor or his acceptance, but putting our trust in what he has achieved on the cross, in bringing us into a place where we can have access to the Father, not by doing the works of the law, but by faith in Christ. And then going on, he says, if while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves are also found sinners, is Christ therefore a minister of sin? Certainly not. For if I build again those things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. Now, what does this section mean? Well, I don't know whether he said this to Peter or whether he's just following on now in the things that he's saying to the people at Galatia. But he's making this point. You see, that idea of the people of God and the sinners, the people of God with a circle around them, if you are outside that circle, you are no longer one of the people of God, and you are subject to a different kind of order of things. But those who are inside, well, that's it. But those who are inside were failing. So they could never achieve righteousness by their own efforts. Now, what Paul is really saying is that because of what's been achieved by the cross, and we'll see more of this in a moment or two, because of what's been achieved by the cross, keeping the law no longer has any effect on our acceptance with God. In fact, the law has come to an end. The purpose of the law, it had a beginning and it had an end. We'll come to this later on. What's the purpose of the law, Paul says? And he says, well, it was added, that's to say, it was additional to that relationship, covenant relationship of Abraham. It was added until. So it had a beginning and an end. It was a covenant that had a start date and an end date. If you have a car and you've got motor insurance, it'll have a beginning date and an end date. And the covenant between God and the people of Israel as his unique people for a unique purpose had a beginning date and an end date. The beginning date was Sinai. The end date was Calvary. So that law no longer operates. But if people then create their own, almost like a grid, almost like a circle, and put it on top of their lives again, they'll find that they're outside it. And consequently, you will actually reinstate the law, and because you're found outside it, now it will seem as though Christ had served sin. You putting your trust in him, if he is not the only solution, you putting your trust in him and him encouraging you to put your trust in him is diabolical. I'm using a strong word so that you'll listen carefully. If he caused us, if he encouraged us to put our trust in him, and if Paul is right in saying it's not by law keeping, then this is diabolical if it's not true, because it means that people are going to keep on sinning because sin is the transgression of the law. But where there is no law, there is no transgression. That's the way it is. You cannot transgress a law that's no longer operable. When our laws of lockdown have ended, we shall do all kinds of things. We'll stand closer to people. We may kind of put our arm around someone's shoulder or something like that that we haven't seen for a long time. And we won't be breaking any laws, because the laws will have come to their end. But if in your own mind you reinstate the laws, you make yourself a sinner. You judge yourself as someone who has broken the law, even though the law is no longer operable. And then Paul says this, "For I," this is where we come into the singular now, this is an emphatic I, "for I, through the law, died to the law, that I might live to God." And then he says this, "I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live." Now, please follow my pattern here. Don't go to Romans for the interpretation of these verses. Not yet. The people who received it first didn't have the letter to the Romans. What's Paul been talking about? He's talking about the law. And what he's really saying is, I am no longer answerable to the law because I'm dead. You know, the law has no power over a dead man. As soon as you're dead, that's it. It's the end of it. Technically, in England at one time, as soon as a man was sentenced to death as after a proper court case, he was regarded as dead, but kind of walking. He couldn't make any decisions concerning his estate or his will or any of those things. He had no power. That's the pattern of it. Once you're dead, the law no longer has any hold on you. So Paul says, the law has no hold on me. And you say, why? And he says, because I've been crucified with Christ. You say, how did this happen? And well, it happened because he was united with Christ by faith and by the gift of the Spirit. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I, there's that emphatic I again, there's no longer I that live. So the Lord's not interested in me because I'm dead. But Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. He began Galatians by saying that he gave himself for us to rescue us from this present evil age. Here Paul personally, on the I level, says, the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. This isn't the death of the old man. This is a different tense of the Greek language. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 6, it uses an aorist tense, which is, when it's used in the past tense, it has a focus on an act in the past, which has been completed. This one here is the perfect tense. It's something which happened in the past, but the effects of it continue into the future. He is co-crucified with Christ, and consequently, it's no longer him who lives, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. And then he says this, I do not set aside the grace of God. For if righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died in vain. If it's possible for us to acquire our own righteousness, then Christ threw his life away for nothing. It's of no value. It's pointless. Faith in Christ plus zero is the way to salvation. If you put anything else into that equation, if you put faith in Christ plus anything, X, law keeping, Sabbath keeping, wearing a head covering, being regular at the prayer meeting, if you put any of those things in that equation, as the X, you've nullified salvation. You've nullified Christ's perfect work. You've added something to something which cannot be added to, can only be subtracted. So this is it. Peter's action has provoked something which has enabled Paul to address Peter personally, to identify the Jews as a people who now have only one way of access to God, not by the law, but by faith in Christ. And for himself, his own personal testimony is that he had died to the law so that he might live to God. I have been and still am co-crucified with Christ. The law can't touch him. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not set aside the grace of God. But if righteousness comes through the law or through any other way, you might put in bracket, and Christ died in vain. Let's go back a verse and end our session. I have been crucified. I have been and still am co-crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Paul lived his life in conscious surrender to someone who had loved him and given his life for him. It's the only way forward, brothers and sisters, to abandon ourselves to him as he abandoned himself for us. All our eggs in one basket. It's not sufficient to believe that Blondell can carry some person across in his wheelbarrow. You have to put your life in his hands. Okay, we better stop. God bless you all. Thank you for being with us. And God willing, I trust to be with you again at the same time next week. God bless you.